Welcome to another podcast, men. This is our eighth in the spiritual coaching series. Today we're going to look at the topic of work. We're transitioning from the basic components of how to care for ourselves spiritually. How will you care for yourself spiritually, and how will you, when you help to coach another man who is less mature, how will you help him to understand the growth process spiritually, what's necessary to feed and care for himself? Today we're moving to a whole other level, and that is, what are the big building block components of a man's life, and what does Scripture teach about each of those? What does the Scripture have to say, for instance, today, about the topic of work, about how we should work, why we should work, or even if we should work? And so I hope that you'll follow along. And guys, if you are using this podcast as a supplement to those weeks when you're not able to attend the Saturday morning study, please feel free to contact us so that you can get any outlines for that particular week that you've missed. Like I said, this is week 8, so look forward to seeing you in the study when you can make it. Please feel free to use this when you can't. And let me recommend that perhaps you suggest this podcast to another man. Maybe someone whom you've invited out to the study, or someone that you have invited to come to church, and maybe they're either not ready or their time schedule doesn't fit showing up on Sunday morning or Saturday morning. So this can be a good first step to introduce a man to our church, to some of the things that we offer. And he can listen along in the comfort of his home, or while he's driving, while he's working out. So it's a good first step to introduce a man to some basic spiritual teaching. As always, guys, thanks for joining us, and look forward to catching up with you again next week. So there are four essential pillars of spiritual training, spiritual development that we've already talked through. Does anybody want to take a swing at what they are? And we moved through them pretty comprehensively in the first 4 weeks. Okay, he's yawning, and everybody else, yes, invest,
plan,
discover,
okay, discover, and practice. So there you have it. Now, have you taken the time to knit these together? Do you understand how they fit together? First in your own life, but then ultimately, remember, this is not just about helping you to grow. This is about helping you to grow into the person who can help others to grow. So, a commitment to invest, but by itself, not enough. And that's why we say these are four pillars, and you need all four in place in order to build a solid plan. So, a commitment to invest, a plan for that investing. With that plan in place, then you begin to discover new things. You discover things about yourself. You discover things about what God is asking from you. And then ultimately, practice. And the practice will probably reveal weaknesses, help you to discover even more. Force you back to your plan. Force you to revise your plan. From there, you move forward again into new discovery, new practice processes. And so I'll single out Justin. So it's been a while. We've been working together. Are you doing anything in your life differently than you did, say, 2 years ago? Are you beginning to develop rhythms of doing something? It's not an isolated event, but it's becoming more a habit to practice these things. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, because as I'm, you know, putting it, like I just discussed with you in the beginning, like we're practicing or talking about you being more positive instead of throwing everybody under the bus and jumping on the bandwagon. Like, I notice myself now, it's like, I notice everybody else doing it, and then I'm kind of like on the outside, I really shouldn't do this. And it's, I'm getting in, trying to turn over that and just be like, oh, you know, he's a good guy for this and this, you know, for different things, instead of jumping on the bandwagon and throwing him under the bus, trying to change it. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's definitely, it's a work in progress.
Okay. Until you are implementing all four of these in your own life, it's going to be very tough for you to meet with someone and help them to understand why this should be important to them. That's very clear. After we moved through those four pillars, then we started to talk about the three essentials of identity, position, and purpose. Would somebody like to describe why those are foundational to us? Why they will drive and influence everything that we do? You know, it's okay to it's okay to just try to offer some explanation here. The first time you meet with someone and try to explain it, you may trip over yourself a little bit. That's okay. That's part of practice. If you were perfect already, you wouldn't need practice. So this is a good, safe place to practice. Let's talk about why understanding who you are, what your standing is with God, and what your purpose is. Why is that foundational to everything that we will do?
It's hard to lead somebody somewhere when you don't know where you're at.
Okay. There's a good explanation. Any others?
Helps you figure out your level of maturity.
All right. Anything else? Oh, there's a good one. Confidence. Right. How many of us spend time beating ourselves up, doubting who we are, wondering who we are, confused about who we are?
Who's going to follow that?
There you go. Who's going to follow that? Who wants to sit down with somebody else who's confused? Remember what Jesus said? If one blind person leads another, where are they both going to end up? In the ditch. You're already in the ditch. You don't need to follow somebody else who's in the ditch. So understanding who you are, why you're here, it matters. Jim.
You know what the cool thing is about that is if you both discover that you're in the ditch, you can both get out. But you both have to realize, wait a minute, if we do this together, we can probably get out. That's how a lot of marriages that show up here can get kind of knit back together, relationships can get knit back together because they both realize, oh, I thought I was the righteous one, he was the idiot. Maybe not so much.
There's a discovery process. Comes right back to what we're talking about. You said you realize, I discover where I am. I didn't really know why I was in the ditch. I didn't know that the ditch wasn't the best place to be. I discover that there's a better place to be than the ditch. And I also start to discover that there are plans for getting me out of the ditch. All right. And then finally, we talked about the significance of the lies we buy into and the aggressiveness of the attempts that the lie makes to get back into us. Somebody want to describe that? Better than I just did.
What would you say? You said describe the deception.
Yeah, what is the lie challenge? Where does that come from? How do we cope with it? How many of you at one point or another in your life were pretty sure that you had a good handle on how life worked? Okay, that was at some point when you were what? Early 20s or something like that, and then along the way you discovered that maybe you really didn't understand everything about how life worked. How many of you have had to let go of some things in your life? You thought this was the right thing to do, the right way to be. How many of you have been shocked at the deception that if somebody would have only come along 10 or 15 or 20 years earlier and told you, no, if you go this way, this is probably going to take you to places you don't want to go to?
I was in recovery for 20 years. I thought I knew God. Because when he taught me this, I thought I knew God. Turns out not so much. I knew their perspective, their perception. That's what I knew. Now I know something different about God. And I believe even more.
So we are surrounded by the lie in general. We eat the lie. We breathe the lie. And it's only through this discovery process that we can start to discern the difference between the lie that we have built our life on, foundationally, versus the truth. Again, comes back to what Jesus said. If you build your house on the sand, sooner or later it's going to crumble. And a guy looks at his life and he says, well, I'm doing pretty good today. That doesn't mean your foundation's good. It just means the storm hasn't been hard. Think about that.
I can swim.
The fact that you have not experienced the storm that attacks the foundation doesn't mean that it's not coming, and it doesn't mean that you have a good foundation. So people go into marriage like this. People go into marriage bringing all their own baggage, their own issues, their own problems, and they think, well, it'll get better when I get married. And then they find out, well, I built my house on this, and it's not that. And then it starts to crumble. All right. How many of you have found some of what we've talked about thus far sort of theoretical, like it was tough to get your head around how you would live it out? Has anybody found that? Yeah. That's why I said that we're moving into, transitioning into a new phase where we actually start to look at, now that I know the basics of caring for myself, and these were the basics, this is how I care for myself. Commit to invest in myself, have a plan for that, begin to work out that plan that leads me to discoveries. I start to practice the discoveries. In other words, I discover who I am and I say, I don't like that, I'd like to change. I discover things about God that I can trust in and I say, I'd like to live my life that way, and I start to practice that. So we simplified that into a three-step formula, incidentally. The first step was learn, the second was understand, the third was practice. Learn, understand, practice. Repetitive cycle goes on for the rest of life. So now we're going to start to look at what are the components of a guy's life where we live this out. Until this idea meets everyday life, most men struggle to deal with it. It sounds like great material to learn, but I'm not sure what I do with it once I've learned it. So today we're going to look at the component of work in a man's life, but before we do that, how many of you feel that your life is a collection of individual compartments and you leave one to go to the next?
Less now than I used to.
Explain yourself a little.
In my younger years, you know, we called it a mask. And there was a mask at work, there was a mask at home, there was a mask out with the boys on the bikes, there was a mask here, there was a mask there. Like, these were individual things. It wasn't just my mom's gym. I had to be a certain way with the fellas, I had to be a certain way at home with the wife, I had to be a certain way, at work. And so it was different than it is now. Now I'm just me. Wherever I go, I do my best to just be, this is who I am, you get what you get. I try to be as genuine as I can. Sometimes that's uncomfortable for people. You know, at work when somebody's doing something now, and I don't just keep my mouth shut, or buy into the lie and jump on the bandwagon and say, whoa, we don't do that. It's not what we do here.
Okay, let me pause you there. Jim described something that we all experience when we're not grounded in one of the things that we've talked about already. Did anybody pick up on that? There you go. Without your own unique identity that you know who you are, you become a chameleon. You float, you flex, you conform in order to fit in wherever you are. And in the end, the more you do that, the more you lose your identity. Pretty soon you really don't know who you are. One of the great gifts that God gives us when He calls us His Son is He gives us a new identity. He gives us a fresh identity. Now, how easy that is to live out that new identity in all the spheres of our life is that can be the challenge.
Well, if you don't know who you are, then you are a liar.
That's true.
And people will define who you are or tell you who you are.
Well, there's
a culture, a world.
You jump in the pool, you're going to get wet. When you head out these doors, it's not our sacral environment here where we can all, you know, talk amongst ourselves and be Christians together. You got to live out in the world where people are going to say mean things to you. They're going to act up around you. And the world nowadays, I mean, it is absolutely bonkers out there how people treat one another. just crazy. You know, I'm not so sure that love exists out there anymore. Like genuine love exists out there. But we are called to do. So when you do step out there, don't forget, you're going to get wet.
Well, I think love exists wherever we take it.
That's my point, is that we're going to be the ones bringing it to the party. Hey, you don't have to swim in there, you know that. That's infested with stuff. Here, give me your hand. Let me help you out of it. Get out. It's not good. It's not good for you.
All right, so over the next... Over the next number of weeks, we're going to look at several components, and I don't want us to look at these individual silos as if we live in this and then we step out of this to go into that. Because when you read the scriptures, you don't see that. If there are any real divides, it is the tendency that we'll break it down into there is work and then there is rest. There is work expression, and then there is Sabbath, where I remove myself from my work. But it's not as if in the scriptures you see a man described as a worker, and then he goes home and he's with his family. So for a little while he's a family person, and he goes and he does some fun thing in recreation, so he has this component of his life. All of life is fused together. We don't experience that quite the same way. We've talked about the reasons for that. When people come together and organize communities and become more unique and specialized in what they do, it tends to fracture us. So we don't just work. We typically, what do? We go off to work. And our family doesn't go along with this, so we go to a separate place for a specified amount of time. And in that separate place and time, we do something that we call work. We derive from that some form of compensation, and we take that compensation home, and then with that we care for our family, which becomes a whole separate component of life. And it's as if we tend to separate them. So here's the proof of this. How many of you have ever had a great day at work and then come home? And I just don't even need to say anything more. We'll just stop it right there. How many of you have had that experience? Or the reverse of that. How many of you have had a great weekend with your family and then gone to work?
And it's funny because that used to be a reverse for me. I used to love going to work. Love it.
Now there's a certain health benefit to that. Like if all of your life is going wrong all at once, it's really bad. It's like everybody wants to have some area of life that they can escape to that seems to be going well. So like if your family life is not going well, but your work is going well, you sort of retreat to your work. Or the reverse of that.
Men like to do what they're good at. I'm good at that. I'm going to do that. I'm not real good in relationships. I'm not going to be over there a lot. It's been my experience.
I agree with you. So let's turn over to your page 21. Page 20, you can finish reading that yourself. Together at the top of page 21, we were created as those who would be givers and receivers. We've corrupted that initial plan, deluding ourselves and being deluded into believing that our real strategy should be as producers/deliverers and takers. In other words, I do something and then I get something back for it. That's really not the way the Genesis narrative describes our original creation purpose. But just take a moment and think about this. Can you give freely and receive freely? Can you give without expectation? In other words, give without it being attached to an expectation for getting something back. And can you also equally well receive without an internal expectation that at some point in time you have to give back?
That's tougher in today's society. I think decades and centuries back when you had a community that, you know, in the heart, in the time of harvest, literally everybody in the community went to this farm and did that farming, and then, you know, this, and, you know, one out of five people had a plow and had to pass it around. And, you know, I think it's different today when there is that, you know, a lot of people do struggle with, they have to do something for you. They have to do something if you do something for them. Especially if they're the ones who, you know, you're trying to be that Christian, trying to help them out in that situation where they're already uncomfortable, and, you know, you're the one giving them money because they need money, and then, you know, years down the road, they're still saying how, oh, I'm going to get you back, you know, going to make that right with you or something like that. It's already right. It was right the day I did.
You know, Brad, that's funny, because all the stuff of mine that you have stored in the loft over your garage, I don't struggle with that. I've received that freely over the years. And I haven't felt bad at all.
I tell people when they start to get like that, stop it. You're robbing me now. I wanted to do this. I wanted to. Somebody was going to get blessed with that. You have to be standing in front of me. Awesome. That's you. One of the big lies that I was told for years is that everything that I received was for me, for my consumption. Every dollar, every cent was for me. That was for my consumption. And now I'm taught that's not even yours. That's for you to bless somebody else.
Right.
Your needs are met. Take the extra. Bless somebody.
Well, now you brought up something that we should take some time to discover. John, do you need longer arms or glasses?
Mind your own business.
What was the lie that he just described there? That I work to get something that's mine. Well, what does that make the purpose of my work then? It's extraction. I go somewhere to get something from somebody else, preferably for the least amount of effort possible. I take that home, and then it is mine to use as I please. Turn over to Genesis 2. And I realize that this is a simple story. But I think there's still things that can be learned here. All right, so we're going to have to do a little bit of background reading. We'll just start at the beginning of the chapter here. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from his work that he had done in creation. All right, we'll jump down to verse 5. When no bush of the field was yet in hand, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land, and there was no man to work the ground, and a mist was going up from the land and was watering the whole face of the earth. Then the Lord God formed the man of the dust from the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The man became a living creature. All right, now, I don't want to bore down into this and treat this like as if it is a scientific text. We're just going to talk about it and glean from it what I think we can all agree on. And here are some of the things that I definitely think we can all agree on here. God was very intentional about how and when he created mankind.
Yeah.
It was a very specific, purposeful act. At the end of it, it says God breathed life into him. There is supposed to be an intimate connection between our life and God's. And when our life and God's are separated, our lives are depleted. So here we are, and you cannot read this verse without reading the next one. The two of these are intended to go together. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Draw a conclusion for me there.
Put the garden first.
Now he put the garden in second, but go on.
He put the garden here. Then he plucked the man in the garden.
With purpose, intention, and love, God created a unique species. And he gave them immediately a unique purpose and place. When we forget that, when we lose our way in that, we start to lose our identity and a sense of purpose. The Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord made to spring up every tree that was pleasant to the sight and good for food. All right.
When, not to get all down another road, but when you see the specifics of that, so you take away creation and we say we believe in evolution, right there you begin to devalue life itself, purpose itself, identity itself. So it's all the same, it's no different. And so right there you begin to see, like you just said, the intentionality of the specifics of that, and the purpose of that, of man.
That's why I said I don't want to get lost in, well, how did this take place? How many thousands or millions of years did it take? This or that. To me, that is less important than this primary fact. Here we can say that the Scripture is trying to teach something specific. There was a time when we weren't, and then there was a time when God intentionally brought us, unique human beings, into being, breathed life into us, and immediately placed us somewhere where we could be provided for and have purpose. And we haven't gotten into the provided for yet, Jim.
Well, it was just, I wish I could remember what it was. It was a movie, and it talked about how we need purpose. We need something that, he said, it was expressed where, if you give a man something to do, he'll do it. But if he doesn't know what to do, he won't do anything. So you just have to make sure that you give him something to do. Hey, I need this done. Come follow me.
Mm-hmm.
I need this done. We need to get this thing done. Okay, sure. Yeah, all right. I ain't got nothing going on. Okay, they'll do that. But if you don't give a man anything to do, he'll sit in the chair. For 38 years, he'll lay by that pool. You don't give him anything to do. You know, he needs to do it.
Yep.
So it's just one of those things. And I think that right away in the garden, there was stuff to do. You know what I mean? We were provided for it, but a garden still needs to be tended, pruned, cared for, raked up. You know, hey, keep the place nice. I think there are things that we do.
And actually, talking about that, you took a little long to say that, but what you got to another crucial point here. Did you ever watch a young guy who doesn't have purpose? He'll get a job because he needs money. He doesn't have any idea why he's working. He gets a job because people need money, and the only way to get... If you can get money and stay at home, that would be okay. But since you can't... What's that? Well, okay. Only in America, right? But anyway, we're moving on. We're not stopping there.
But there's all the negatives to that, but yeah.
But somehow you look at a number of young people and they don't yet have that sense of purpose. And so work is merely extraction. It's mining. I dig into something, I get something for me, and I take that home to my cave. And it's mine. It sounds like the Precious in the Lord of the Rings thing, right? All right, we're moving on. So verse 10, it goes into a little bit of a tangent here where all of a sudden there's this offshoot and it starts to describe where Eden is. And if you understand this and you read it carefully, it seems to imply that there is a garden within a larger realm that is this realm of Eden. So inside this really nice place, God selects a unique patch of ground and he creates this garden and he places the man in it. And the Lord took the man and put him in the garden. We're now at verse 15. Put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. But stop and think about this. Above here we read that out of the ground the Lord made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. Was the man working to survive there? The man had purposeful, meaningful work because God asked him, take care of my garden. And while you're taking care of it, while you're going about doing this, you get to freely eat everything except for this one thing. And before we get hung up on the one thing, I have a very different take on this. I kind of look at it as if almost, and you're going to laugh at this, but God has this secret, not secret, but this wine cellar where God keeps some choice things for himself. And he says, that's mine. You have free run of the garden. Do whatever you want in this garden. Care for it. Eat the food. Do all that. Have a blast. Have a party every day if you'd like. Stay out of the wine cellar, please. But we're not content. And so what does that make us, honestly? It makes us thieves and takers, and nothing has changed since the beginning. Think about this. God willingly gives, and we are instructed to receive. But we're not happy to receive, so we want to go take.
You see how? Did you ever see a selfish kid get a gift? Did you ever see a kid who doesn't have to get a gift? Two totally different receptions. Kid has everything, opens the box, looks at it, oh, that's cool, throws it on the floor, moves from that box. Kid who doesn't get anything, that kid wonders where the next box is at. The kid who doesn't have anything, opens it up, wow, that's awesome. Looks at it, rolls it over, touches it, rolls it on the floor, plays with it right now. And for what happens is, we're still children, and I think I don't want to be considered a child, but I still act like a child. A lot of days when something goes wrong, when I don't get my way, when I don't believe God is, you know, doing for me what I think he ought to do for me. The old David style, look at him, and you're blessing him, and look at that person, how wicked they are, but what about me? It's kind of childish. Hey, I choose to bless you, I choose to bless. You do your thing, I'll bless you too. Two totally different ways to receive. You can receive gratefully or ungratefully.
Well, receiving is something that we struggle with.
Oh, boy.
I don't think most of us have too much of a problem with giving. But even there, we give with an angle and an edge. So, comes back to my initial question. Can I give freely without any expectation? And can I also receive freely? And that's going to be your challenge for the week. You're getting two pieces of homework. You're going to get the other one at the end, but here's the first one. To really go and evaluate your own motives. Can I give without any expectation? Do I find joy in giving without any expectation of anything in return? Do I look at myself as a giver? And then can I also receive just as graciously, willingly? Those of you who know me even a little bit, which one would I struggle with? All right, I am a very bad receiver. I don't receive well. I have a hard time receiving.
Isn't it hard to just say thanks? Hey, thanks, man. Oh, you didn't have to do that. Why'd you? Oh, come. I can't take that. You have to. It's a gift.
And yet, for this to work, and if it works, I think it works extremely well. I think this is very attractive and very beautiful to a world that is accustomed to taking and then spending on their own pleasure. If I'm a good giver, but there's no vessels to pour into, if there's no willing receivers, then my abilities are thwarted right there. I can't give to bless you unless you will willingly receive it. So we need each other in that. And yet no one wants to be thought of as needy. All right? How many of you want to leave here and think, I'm a needy person?
Yeah.
Pride gets in the way of that. Now, are you needy?
Yes. Sure.
Of course we are. So what do? We lie to ourselves. Oh, I don't want to know. I don't
need anything or anybody. That's a slippery slope.
And we take the joy out of each other's lives when we would like to do something for each other. All right, I'm not going to confess for you. I steal the joy out of other people's lives. Well, try to put some limits or parameters on that, okay?
I'm like that too. It's no big deal because I can do that anyway. If somebody does something for me, and I'm kind of like, okay, whatever, I can do that. I could have done that myself. And it's kind of jerky, you know.
Or
to
just say thank you.
Yeah.
You know, like that's all really, that's it.
Yeah. I always look at it as
nice just to say thank you, not make a big spiel about it. You know, it's like, can I freely give or receive? I wrote, no, my code tends to be want you to like what I'm giving you. I think this is the most special thing in the world. And like Jim's, you know, and like me, and there's even if it's free, in my mind, it's more complicated.
And that's what he's talking about, stealing joy from other people. Sometimes people just need to do that, and you know, just to say thank you should be good enough sometimes. And it's hard for me just to not like say, well, you didn't need to do that because I can do that myself or whatever. But stealing joy from other people, I gotta remember, I do it to my wife all the time.
Gotta take that knee out of the way.
What's wrong with
you? Thank
you. Well, you know, whatever, something, you know, stupid.
Scott.
I used to struggle with receiving. I think the problem is because giving is a challenge. I used to give a lot, but there was a reason. There was something that there was a return on investment for me. If I'm giving something, I want to yield something. And I couldn't just give and let go with no expectation. On the contrary, to receive something, again, I have to connect something for a purpose and a cause. There's a reason why I'm receiving this. I got to get something. Giving it out. And I think part of the reception is a underlying fault of the giving. So concentrating on just giving without any kind of, congratulations or recognition or some kind of expectation is going to come something back because I gave and I'm going to get something. When you get over that hump, the receiving portion becomes easier. And you can have that joy, that gratitude. You can have that, you know, willingness to say thank you, appreciate it, and then leave it go right there without trying to mold it into something bigger. So, for me anyway, focusing on giving without expecting something back makes everything else so much easier.
All right, so let's weave this together a little bit more. How is my ability to successfully give and receive without an expectation or a reciprocity needed, how is that tied to my identity or lack of?
Well, once you understand your identity in God, you understand the grace that we received, you become and it becomes easier to know that God loved us and did this for us with nothing in return. So that's the way we need to be. Gratitude.
Okay.
It's all the security thing. I'm secure.
When
I receive, I'm secure. It's not tied up in any of that.
When my identity is in what I do, then why do I do what I do? Do I do it to bless you or do it to prop up my own identity? Think about that. Have you ever given to make yourself look good or yourself feel better? Have you ever given because there was a hole in you? You weren't really giving to the other person, but the only way you could fill the hole in you was to give, so you gave to the other person, but it was really not about the other person.
Maybe you do it, you do it maybe not wanting any return, but you do it because you figure you can do it better than somebody else can.
So if we struggle with this, and how many of you would say you do struggle with either one or the other, or probably both? And I think it's hard to not struggle with both. Giving freely without expectation of return, or receiving freely. How many of you struggle with that? Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it depends a lot about your personality and how you were raised, too, because you could
you could not struggle with expecting a return, but you could have a really big problem with appearing needy to every person that you try to give something. You're doing it for the right reasons, they're graciously accepting, and even though you want to give, you still feel like there could be bad motives or bad feelings either way. It's just such a gambit of situations that it's always going to be complicated, I think.
It is. And I think most of us haven't. You brought up another interesting point. You said you struggle to do that with your wife. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
The giving and receiving. Now think about that.
The receiving.
What are your children watching?
Yeah, sure.
They're not sure how to give. That is the incubator where this is learned. It's not the only place it can be learned. Fortunately, church, us as family, I don't mean the building and the organization, but church, us as family, is another incubator where this can be learned if we do it well. It's tough to do it well here. So family is really where this is learned. So that's motive enough to start to put this. If you have kids at home or you have influence on your kids yet and they can watch what's being done, your ability to give without expectation and receive joyfully and willingly, and literally bless the giver by receiving happily. Have you ever given something and you weren't asking for anything in return, but there was just no delight in the receiving? You'd almost sense that there was no delight in the receiving. So we want to do both well, and it's important to do both well. All right, so that was our original intention, placed in a garden. Meaningful work. Serve God. And what was the purpose to the work? It was simply to serve God. Eating was all there for us. Survival wasn't in question. So our first purpose was serving God. Now let's move beyond the cliches and say, how many of you wake up every morning and see your work as service to God? Okay, naturally you have to be different. And actually, you and I have had a few conversations, and I've heard you talk about things in those terms. So you've modeled that well. I think you do model that well. There's probably some things that your kids have observed about that, or you've grown into that over the years.
I think everybody knows, though, that maybe that's not your forethought in the morning, but I think for the majority of us understand that our talents come from God, and that, you know, what we put our hands to is from God.
Do you really think we believe that in the day-to-day?
I know I do.
Okay.
I mean, you get up every day, you're in routine your whole life, but the one thing that I know is there is I get up in the morning, I'm rested, confident, you know, just that peace within myself, that I know is there every day. And then you're going to go about my business, but it's there every day. So that I know for sure.
I guess it depends what you do. I mean,
well, I think for a lot of men and what they do, it can be a challenge to see what they do as being a service to God. I think it requires some intention, some purpose, of thought before we leave the house in the morning to say, what I'm doing to bless God's people, God's creatures. We'll call it that. And in doing that, I'm honoring God and I'm serving God. If you're in a customer service sort of a business, I think that can grow weary quickly. Yeah. So you need to be renewed in that. All right, so now we introduce what we call the fall. All right, so what does the fall do? We'll read a little bit here, chapter 3. It just so happened that this overlapped the purple book thing that we're doing, so I get to talk about this twice in a week. Kind of weird. Okay, so now the serpent was more crafty than any of the other beasts of the field that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Did God actually say you shall not eat any of the tree in the of any of the trees in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make her wise, she took its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband." All right. So then God goes looking for them when he shows up. And I want to move down to the curse thing, because this is where everybody gets hung up. Have you ever heard someone say that our work is a curse? Or that work is cursed? And that's not really accurate. Yeah, right, there you go. As a result of, if it wouldn't be for original sin, we wouldn't have to work. And we could all just go around and everything would be wonderful. And he said to Adam, now this is God talking to Adam as the result of what has happened, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall bring forth for it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." All right, now let's just stop there at verse 18. Does anybody have a different translation for 18? Anybody else want to read 18?
"You will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field."
Okay. So think about the difference. God planted a garden. God planted trees in the garden. Not planted a garden. Created a garden. Planted trees in the garden. The trees produce. What about field plants? This is what God is describing. And in a loose sense, here's what he's saying. Up until now, you had what you needed provided for you, and all you had to do was go and harvest it. Now you are going to have to go through the repetitive, perpetual, never-ending cycle of doing what's necessary for the earth to produce what you need to survive from it.
You have to be a farmer now.
And it will never stop. And the moment that you stop doing, your survival will stop. So what is really, there's a couple of things here. He says it's going to be a challenge. But there's also a time factor here.
Yeah, this is the first time they ever thought they were going to die. They said, "You come from dust, you're going to return to dust now."
And that's another ultimate reminder. Now think about this shock. You brought up another thing. You're kind of rushing ahead, but let's go there. If you didn't know that you came from the ground, if you had no idea, remember, Adam didn't have a dad that sat down and said at that appropriate time in life, "Well, son, let me tell you where you came from." That conversation didn't take place. So this was that conversation. Only this time, Adam discovers what? Oh, this is where I'm from. And that's where I'm going back to. So maybe this would be a good birds and the bees talk for you to use. I don't know. Maybe we could run photocopies of this and you could use it for yourself. No, the time issue that I'm talking about here is it never ends. How many of you feel that your work never stops? That it's consuming? That it just goes on and it never stops, and tomorrow you got to wake up and do it again? And that's part of the curse. The fact that you will have to keep doing, that there is now a direct, there was no, pre-fall, there was no direct cause and effect. You did not have to work to eat. God's saying, now you will have to work to eat. Brad.
I think an important detail, though, is that work isn't cursed, right? It's work is good. He put it in the garden to work. I think the important thing, though, is that from the fall on, work became difficult.
Yes.
And a chore.
and ever consumed.
That's right. Frustrated.
Right.
Sometimes unsuccessful.
And so, and this is where it really gets personal now, because work is now hard and it takes this work to survive, my tendency is to become a taker rather than a giver. My perspective now becomes, I've earned this. I've extracted this. It would be very difficult for Adam in the garden to say, well, I earned that piece of fruit. It was there. All he had to do was walk up and pick it up.
I think before, all they were was just eat. All the work, only work they had to do was eat, because there was no thistles and there was no weeds until after the curse. So they didn't really have to tend anything. All they just eat it. I mean, they didn't. You know, I mean, it's not like they had to do anything. Just eat and stay alive.
But they
didn't even have death before that either, because none of them knew they were ever going to die.
God set Adam up in the garden, and it kind of ties into this being takers of the fathers. In 2:15, there he's saying, took man, put him in the garden of Eden to work and take care of him. This is, you know, God created this universe that he's working and taking care of. Puts Adam, little image of himself.
Right, Junior.
We're imitators of our father in that situation. But then come at the fall, it comes that division that we're talking about. I would rather do it myself. I'd rather know myself. Man chose to step away from the full blessings of God.
Mm-hmm.
Still blessings are farming and stuff, but we decided not. Yeah, I got this. I could do that myself, right? Well, okay. God, have at it, you know, but it's not going to be like it was. God is coming, you know, and that's our choice.
All right, so now when you and I talk with other men, what are the impressions of the guys that you work with every day? Why does a man work?
You gotta eat.
Pay bills, gotta eat, gotta do all that stuff. And so, is work something that you do to benefit and bless other people, or is work primarily seen then, among your coworkers, as something that you do so that you can get something? And out of that comes the idea of ownership rather than stewardship. And just think about that. What is Adam's original purpose in the garden? He's a caretaker. He is a steward. God said, just take care of my possessions, my assets here. We've turned that, because it's so easy to see that I have to work to live. If I don't plant the crop, if I don't harvest the crop, I don't eat. Therefore, that crop is now mine. If I plant it, if I harvest it, it's mine. It's very easy to draw that conclusion. It totally changes my perspective on work. I'm no longer working simply because I'm a steward, I'm placed here on planet Earth to be a servant of God. I'm working so that I can take things out of the ground for me, take things from my work for me. How does that change my giving then?
You appreciate what you have.
Well, you do appreciate what you have.
You don't need to work for it, you know, it has more meaning.
Am I liberal with my giving? I can tend to be a little bit more tight-fisted about what I give. And when I see someone who doesn't have as much, what is my attitude then? They should have gotten up earlier, right? They should have tended to their field a little bit better. They should have not slept in that day and should have gotten out there and harvested. And some of that is true, of course. So what I'd like to go back to, and Brian, you did a good job of introducing that idea that we are imitators of our Father. So how does God work? If that is our goal, is to be imitators of our Dad, how does God work? So we're going to look first off at the bottom of page 21, look at some reasons for work. I work to serve and please God. Secondarily, through my work, I'm able to care for myself. Obviously, then, through my work, I'm able to care for and give to those who are close to me. I work as a means of a unique expression. In other words, I pour myself into my work. How many of you do that? How many of you struggle with that? Okay, so to the degree that you can do that, you become an attractive reflection of your Father. To the degree that you struggle with that, that your attitudes are challenged in that regard, you become a distorted view of your Father. So in that sense, your work is much more than just a means to care for yourself. Our work as guys is one of the chief ways that we reflect our Father. I work so that I can store up surplus to provide for those who at this moment can't work. And I put a verse there for you to look up later. I work for the simple joy and delight of being useful and purposeful. Anybody want to make any comments on any of them? Now, I'll guarantee that most of the people that you meet don't have that attitude about work. Not all of that attitude about work.
I think that last one, simple joy and delight of being useful and purposeful, I think that is so declining so quick, it's almost embarrassing, you know, to admit what country we live in sometimes. I appreciate this country, but I mean, that's a sad reality. And it's a shame. We're made to work, and work is good, it's good for you. I just can't imagine not having the perspective that I keep up my end. Others should too.
Well, and if we're all in the boat together, and even if the boat could continue to float and continue to go where the boat needs to go without our efforts, what would we all do? Just stand against the railing and stare over the side? See, even though we're given an identity, we all have to look inside ourselves and say, what do I know about myself? Work gives me a sense of respect for myself. Not that it is my identity, but it does help me to find respect in myself. And when I fail to be productive, when I fail to give my best, How many of you have watched somebody who doesn't want to give their best? That's poison to your soul. Now, I know that a lot of people wouldn't get that, but that is. The day you decide you're not going to give your best, that you're going to hold back, there's a little bit of you died that day. Because, it seeps in so slowly, and then it'll start to infect some other area, and then another area. Again, as coaches to other men, we're going to meet men who have decided long ago that they're not going to give their best. One of the cool things about this is God gives new life and new opportunity. So you can, over a period of time, help a man to change his attitude. Okay, top of page 22. I'm going to wrap this up pretty quickly. We work like God when we work at something until it is complete or finished. I don't mean that project in your basement either. Oh, okay. But that is the general trend. When we see God doing something, He doesn't start the project and say, good enough. He brings His best to it, and He brings it to completion. And that, I think, is a real hallmark of those of us who are going to be God's kids. We try every day to bring our best to it. We try to bring a sense of completion to it. Sometimes we start more than we can finish. That's another amazing quality of God. He doesn't seem to start things that He doesn't finish. And our aren't we all glad? Think about this. Aren't we all glad that Jesus finished what he came to do and didn't just start what he came to do? Oh, this is a little hard. This is a little bit more than I expected. These people aren't nice to me. I don't think I want to finish what I came here to do. So I think we are most like God. We work like God when we start something and follow it through to completion. We talked about this one also. We work until something is not only finished, but finished well. And this gets back to the giving your best. I work for people and not only for gain. There is purpose beyond profit. So that's a personal reflection item. My work is a gift to others, even when I'm compensated for it. So do you see how you're blessing people with what you do? Have you drawn the connection between your actions and people's benefit? Because I think until you do that, you find your work to be meaningless. People who cannot draw a link between what they do and how it blesses or benefits other people typically work simply to extract a paycheck from what they do. And they're miserable. A sense of calling and blessing will pervade my attitude about what I do. And it's at that point that I think I want to talk about your second homework assignment here. What I've done, we'll read one of them. Let's turn over to the Romans 1:1. I've put a collection of scriptures down there at the bottom that you can use to sort of help you. And at first you're going to laugh at this and you're going to say, well, that was Paul or that was Peter, or what do I have that's like that? You can find some similar phrase at the opening of almost every one of Paul's letters. Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. What do you see there? In a single sentence, he describes who he is and what he does. And also why it matters. Do you have some concise mission statement, purpose for who you are and what you're about? Do you really know who you are and what you're about? And it's not necessarily going to be that you're called to be an apostle. What are you called to be?
Sir, son.
Got a couple of good answers there already. There's a collection of them. One of the things that I find that men struggle with really is what their purpose is. Why am I here? What am I to do with my life? So I'd like you to take some time to write this down, to really think through this. Read these scriptures that I've put here. That's your homework for the week, the second half of your homework. Think about the level of confidence that it takes for a man to say this. I think we're going to end with that. Get you out of here early today.